How are we doing, everybody? And welcome back to the Sean Atwood channel with myself, Ron Swanson, and John Wedger for the first episode of our new live series of Crime Theory. Now, I'm assuming the algorithm has been screwed up this evening because we had a bit of a technical difficulty trying to stream on a couple of different places. So I think next week's probably going to be our big successful launch, if I'm being honest with you. But for those of you who are here this evening, we've got an absolute banger from the mind of John Wedger. His research and his knowledge and all of this is second to none. And John, obviously, it's been a while since we've seen each other. What's been happening with you and how have things been?
Well, I'm busy, but always busy in different avenues, you know. But what I'm putting together at the moment, a documentary called Redemption. It's a short testimonies of different people who have been caught up in crime, sinful living. It's got a very strong sort of Christian connotation to it, but some people are very well known, others aren't. You know, we've got ex-drug addicts, ex-prostitutes, ex-murderers, special forces soldiers, things like that, that have really been caught up in violence and criminality and all sorts, but something's changed, and it's not the system that changed them. It wasn't medication, it wasn't therapy, it was a higher calling that changed them, and this one is on the works of Jesus Christ and how they've changed their lives as a result, and they've gone on to do tremendous benevolent work.
That's awesome.
It's good. I'm really, really keen. We've already started, but it's just like most things, it's getting the right people in the right order, and herding cats, they call it, you know. But that's my only difficulty at the moment. But you know, I'm pleased to be back doing this. I'm getting a lot of inquiries that people are making, and I've had a few ex-coppers get in touch with me that have gone into the world of speaking out against their paymasters and realised that it's not as easy as they think, and it's quite a dangerous world. So
I'm sure they're realizing it pretty fast, John.
Yeah, they will. That's what I said to them. I said, make sure you know what you're doing.
Anyone who feels like they want to come and have a rant and get some things off their chest anonymously or otherwise, they're welcome to come and do it here. But I just want to say thank you to everyone who's joined us. Dirty Mac, William, we've got our mod team out in force, and it's good to see everybody. So let's sort of set the stage, John. I think people kind of know from my background and your background where this is going to go, but sort of set the stage for us on this.
Well, in the last series, we connected. The feedback I got was so positive, and people were saying, you know, you're connecting things that the national media and policing haven't connected. Especially when we started looking at the cases of Leslie Mulseed and Moira Anderson, the works of Fred West and stuff like that. And it is amazing. You know, we've got to understand it's a small world. And people, they know each other. They're, in the business world, they're connected. In the military world, they're connected. In the policing world, they're connected. Everyone's connected, you know, whether direct or indirectly. Yeah. And the same goes for the criminality. And a lot of the cases that we looked at last time were to do with child murdering. And with that comes the abuse. And we also sort of aired on more sinister, ritualistic connotations to it. So we've got to look at, you know, how do these people operate in the shadows? How are they allowed? And these things just sort of come my way and I start looking into them. And it was by chance someone sent me a message the other day and said, you've got to watch this. And it was a documentary that came out in 1975. And I put out a little video the other day, basically commending the national media for their work during the 80s and early 90s in mainly exposing organised child abuse rings, but also ritual abuse. You got heavy hitters like Roger Cook. Did a program called In Satan's Name, which exposed ritual abuse, incredibly exposed it as well, with the backing of a member of parliament called Jeffrey Dickens. And he went out and spoke to ex-abusers, ex-cult members, and victims and survivors. So they did good work back then. Unfortunately, we don't get that from the media now. And we saw that with the appalling documentary that Channel 4 put out last week, trying to debunk the reality of the Hampstead abuse case, which was...
I watch a lot of garbage TV, John, right? And at the end of that garbage TV, every night was that documentary, okay, about that case. And I've not even had the will to click on it, just going by the title. Big shout out to Asha. Good to see you here. But this is another thing, John. Last series, the thing that you blew my mind with was the patterns, right? You're talking about how people are connected, yeah. Right? But it's not so much the connections. It's because you kind of convinced yourself that we know that these things exist and there's this higher evil. So when you hear that these people are all intertwined, it's not as shocking as when you realize there's like a blueprint for these.
Yeah,
for
well,
these
there's an algorithm for everything.
An algorithm, thank you.
And we've got to look at how they operate, and it's all the grooming process. Once you understand the grooming process, and then you've got to then look at the mindset back in the day. And the geography and the demography or whatever the word might be, you know, the demographics of it. Catholic priests got away with murder and the R word of young and vulnerable children and women in Southern Ireland because of the hold that the Catholic Church had. Yeah. They couldn't get away with that in the UK because we're Protestant. But there'll be other things that we will fall foul to because of the weaknesses we have. And if you look back into, you know, the 50s, 60s and 70s, there was a real passion for authority. We'd just come out of the war. Kids' homes become a huge business. And no one ever questioned authority. They can't believe that police officers would be corrupt. It wouldn't be in England. They said that Dixon and Doc Green sort of mentality, and they refuse to accept it. And they, you know, and more recently, people refuse to accept that rock stars, comedians, well-known comedians, you know, I'd love to open my gob on that one. One day my time will come. Yeah. But what we're up to this now, you know, because of my career, my policing career, and the time. Working on sensitive inquiries as a detective, you know, we've got information, and there's a world of difference. Well, there is and there isn't between evidence and intelligence. Evidence has to pass a threshold. Intelligence doesn't, but intelligence in itself is graded on a matrix system. You know, the least credible uncorroborated at the bottom, the corroborated stuff at the top. And just because it doesn't attain evidence, because a statement's not made and it's not put for court, doesn't mean it's rubbish. And when you've got more than one source, and then when you look at like two sources saying the same thing, then you look at three sources saying the same thing about the same person, totally untied, unconnected to each other, we've got a journalistic standard of evidence. And we would hear this so much about certain, in the police, certain actors, certain singers that people thought were brilliant. I wanna spill the name on a footballer. Everyone who thinks he is the business.
Well, this is the curse you have, John. Right? It's the gift and the curse you have. The gift of this knowledge and the curse that, you know, sadly your lips are sealed.
The other thing we got to look at
until it's you know able to be dropped effectively. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and also because we're exposing things on this show and many others. Yeah. The one thing you know about Satanists are they're vexatious litigants, and they are. They will try and sue you for next to nothing, you know. I mean, I had one moron took out an injunction against me, and I'd only spoken to him twice, you know, and that was not in a negative way at all. But they're just strange people. But say there is that hatred, that anger, and that need to shut you down. So whatever content I put out there, I know that YouTube will censor me if I say certain words and will cut the figures down. But in addition to that, my mind's always working because the Satanists do the same to my videos. They sit there. There's one individual at the moment, one toothless old hag, who does exactly the same. And she'll do the same to this. She'll sit there. They're all the same. They sit there with the video going, rolling up a fag, you know, like... you know, in their flat somewhere or whatever. And, oh, man, they're all the same. They're all odd, weird people. And if I said it was Tuesday, this woman would say it was Wednesday, you know? She'd argue with herself in the mirror. But you can see she's got an agenda, and they'll go through and they will transcribe everything, try and find fault and put it out there. So we're always up against this. But at the end of the day, we're here to sort of put out what's out there already and connect dots. And yeah, what I've got today, the BBC did a good bit of journalistic work. It was quite clever how they did it. And in 1975, they put out a program called Johnny Go Home. And it was about runaway kids in London. And it all centered around central London and the Playland arcade, which crops up all the time and has cropped up in the stuff we did about Sidney Cook. Okay, so now, this today is about a guy called Roger Gleaves, Gleaves, right? He's now 90, 89, 90, circa that. He was born in 1935 in Marylebone, London. His mum was a lady called Elsie, and his father was William Gleaves. And his father was a manager in Harrods. He had two sisters and a brother. Now, the people that we spoke on before about Brian Fields, Sidney Cook, and a few others, and the Wests, there is this documented abuse that they've come from the care homes and all this. Doesn't seem to be too much on this guy Gleaves in his early years. All we know is that from very early age, he was placed into a residential children's homes, boarding schools. So we can only assume that he had a bit of a rough time, because this guy really is something else. He's a dangerous man. He was actually, the Sun newspaper classed him in 1990 as Britain's most evil man. And there's a lot of missing persons, and there's a lot of connections with the P people. The P people who...
Just wanted to say, it was Johnny Go Home 1975, you said it was, right?
Yeah, Johnny Go Home.
So I found that. I'll stick that in the side chat for everybody.
It's very well done. It is very well done. Now what this guy did, he set himself up as community service warden. So he would get a uniform. This was when he was, I don't know, maybe in his 40s or something. And he had a uniform, looked a bit like the old Salvation Army uniform. Him and another guy, they were community service officers from the old Catholic Church of Great Britain, which is some bizarre offshoot that the Vatican disowned. And what we found with the government inquiry, the IICSA inquiry, when we looked at ecclesiastical abuse, especially involving the Catholic Church, that 80% of Catholic organizations, you know, like the Church of Vincent so and so, and the Church of the Holy this and Church, they're disenfranchised from the Vatican. They don't come under Vatican rule. They're self-governing. Look at this guy. This is himself. He self-proclaimed the Bishop of Medway. Now, I want to go on about this bloke. I'm going to give you a timeline of his offending. And I'm going to show you how this man is linked in to some of the biggest P cases, offending against children, especially in central London, around the Piccadilly Meat Rack, Playland Arcade. But we're going to link this in to the intelligence services. There's a link to the royal family, and there is a big link to police corruption. Okay, so
it's just echoing from season one. I just want to say to everybody there, I'm also reading the side chat. So if my laughing at the side chat lines up with John saying something horrific, I can assure you it's something in the side chat. So I just want to put that out there
So let's give you a bit of a rundown. He's quite an imposing character, quite a tall character. He kept himself in good shape. At the age of 27, in 1959, Winchester Crown Court, Gleaves was jailed for 3 years for abusing young boys whilst acting as an army cadet instructor. So again, we're looking at abuse of a position of trust, came across as being a military guy and used it as an advantage to prey on young boys. You know, so he got done for, you know, some boys, but how many did he actually abuse, you know? And again, this is his first documented offending history. And the fact of the matter is, as we know, that what people get caught for is a very small percentage of what they actually done. So at the age of 27, this man was well underway for a career in offending against young boys. In 1964, he sort of self-proclaimed himself the Right Reverend Roger Gleaves, Vicar General of the Old Catholic Church of Great Britain. Now, the Old Catholic Church of Great Britain ran out of a dingy flat in North London in the King's Cross area back then, and they would actually hold services in someone's front room. And he sort of aligned himself with them. So he's got in before as some sort of army cadet, ex-military guy. You can trust me, I'm a good fella. So he's covered that base, got caught. He now moves on to the church. So he's can abuse it in an ecclesiastical disguise, you know, under that. In 1969, he calls himself Major Gleaves and sets up the Voluntary Service Corps, which was a uniform movement, which is a bit like how he came onto this documentary, which I'm going to come to in a minute. So he set himself as this uniform youth movement, but they shut him down because they found out that he was actually, you know, a member of the P gang, you know. So and he was a convicted an abuser of boys. So he didn't last long, but he's a slippery guy. And what you find with a lot of people with this sort of offending, convictions as offendings, they don't tend to be much history of them going through like the university of crime, as it were. So if you get an armed robber, it's unlikely that an armed robber's just got one conviction for armed robbery. You'll find that they've got convictions for assault, violence, theft, common assault, you know, petty theft, higher, more value theft, and then accumulating in violence and theft, which becomes robbery. And so you see this history of offending, this chronology of offending. The P people don't tend to have that. If they have anything, is a little bit of profiling for. If they have any conviction, it tends to be for fraud, because these are deceivers. Okay? So it doesn't stop him. In 1971, he gets 6 months suspended for indecent assault on a 13-year-old boy. He then goes and sets up a number of hostels around London to catering for homeless young men. So he sets up these hostels, and what he's doing is he's exploiting a loophole in which he can claim their benefit, gives them an address, and then they then go on to 1 second. I'm just going to turn my camera around a little bit. We got that there. Right. So I just had to let one of my staff in. He sets up these hostels, and he then gets them to claim benefit, and which he sort of pounces off them. And then what he does also, he gets them working as security guards, even young boys. So he's going around as this community service fella, you know, proclaiming to be part of the Old Catholic Church Great Britain. He links in with the police, and he starts patrolling vulnerable spots. And I want to really come on to something in a minute, and this is something I came across a couple of years ago. He starts patrolling the main conduit for young boys into this country, and that used to be Euston Station. And bizarrely enough, it never really become a vice patrol, and it should have been, because this is where the kids came in, and most of them came in from Euston Station. And if you watch any documentary on Savile, that's where his nephew said that's where he got him from, sort of Euston Station, and right next door to St. Pancras, next door to King's Cross. And they're very, very close together. And this is where a lot of the kids from the main sort of surface area of the UK come in. You know, some come in from the South London stations or Paddington. Most of them come in from Euston or King's Cross. And this guy would set himself up, go round, set up a soup kitchen outside, run by his hostel workers, which a lot of them turned out to be rent boys. And he'd say, come on, we'll get you a place to stay. We'll get you sorted out. It's all official, all above board. We're good people. We work with the police. Got a uniform very similar to the police, with epaulettes on and a blue jumper and whatnot, with all sort of insignia on it. And then they get them a hot cup of soup and a roll, put them in a van, fill out some paperwork, and then they were in a life of sexual servitude to this guy. And there was a lot of violence that went. So in 1973, there were rumours in the Brixton area, because he had these hostels all over London, and he was just using the benefit system in order to sort of glean all of this, you know. So he was really tying in with that. So there was rumours within the Brixton area that there's a male brothel in Brixton, which was one of his hostels, and it was run by a priest. So that came to notice of the authorities. The same year that the police raid the same hostel and find that it's been cultivating cannabis. So they've been selling cannabis, growing it and everything else. So this guy, he's into all sorts. Now, in 1974, a staff member at his Brixton hostel gets so concerned about what's going on. And Cleves is sleeping with these boys. They are getting rented out.
Oh, there we go. Hang on 1 second, John. Can you hear me? I can't hear you, John. Can you just press the mic on and off tab? Can you hear me, John? Can you guys in the side chat hear me? Can you guys hear me? Uh-oh. John, yeah, John, you're muted. Yeah, John, you can hear. Okay, John, can you hear me? John. We can't hear you. Turn the mic on and off. Can't hear you. 1 second. Yo, yeah, we can't hear you, mate. If you leave the chat, if you leave the stream and then come back in, because your camera dropped about a second before your sound cut off. All right, well, we're just going to solve these technical difficulties. Bear with me. Let me just do this. Let me try that. No, still can't hear you, mate. Yeah, there we go. Leave the whole thing. There we go. So John will be back in a second anyway, but it's just one of these cases, again, where we're in this era, okay? And when I was working with Phil Chalmers, I described it as like the golden era of crime, right? Where there's no CCTV, there's no internet, news travels super slow, and people haven't really realized on a public mass level the true depravities of mankind. And it's sad that it also is mirrored, this golden era of crime is mirrored with these child P words.
Hello.
We're good. There we go. Yeah, anytime that happens, John, the fix is to just leave.
Someone rang, I think, and that's what put it all out.
That's what it is. But at least you know now, if it happens again, just duck in and out, and we're good, mate.
Right, so if we go back to this guy in 1974, there's a murder of one of his residents, a lad called Billy McPhee, and he was tortured to death. And four members of Gleaves' residential home in Brixton were convicted of it. And what the inference is that Gleaves used this guy to be tortured so he might come up with information about another member of Gleaves' staff who was going to spill the beans. And apparently Gleaves did mention something about, if anyone grasses me up, I'll tell the whole world what really goes on. And so we can only infer that it's important to look at the year 1974. It's important to look at that. I'm going to come back to this. This bit, I need to just go through his offending, and then I'm going to explain something.
All right.
Right? So in 1975, Panorama or Granada or one of those make this documentary, Johnny Go Home. And it's all about runaway children and how vulnerable they are in central London and how they're exposed to sex work. The people prey on them, and especially at certain locations such as Playland, which is the amusement arcade just off of Piccadilly, which so much was going on there. So much was going on. Why this place was never shut down, I'll never know. But it goes to show how these kids are groomed and recruited, that have come from vulnerability, come from abuse within the home, run away from it all and get caught up in this very, very dark world. And kids go missing. Let's get this right. Kids go missing. All right. So 1975, this came out. Okay. The same year, 1975, Glee stands trial and is sentenced for an offence of buggery. He remains in prison for 2 years, and in 1977 he's released. And the documentary Johnny Go Home, it follows the path of a young boy called Tommy Wiley, who's we never really get to know how old he is, but they say 17, but someone said he might have been 12, and he runs away from domestic abuse that's in his hometown of Glasgow, and he ends up in the streets of London. And Wiley ends up being picked up by Gleaves. And you think, oh, God, this kid's in danger. This kid's going to get in trouble. But Wiley, for some reason, hangs around with Gleaves. But we see this quite a lot because sometimes these young boys are used as a lure to get other boys in. And we definitely saw it with the works of Audrey Harper, the ex-street prostitute and self-proclaimed former Satanist, now born-again Christian. And she writes about it in her book, how she would be used as a street prostitute in London to get other young prostitutes and young kids involved in these sex parties and taken to rituals and abused and all sorts. So this is the path they use and how they actually do this. But in 1980, this young resident, Tommy Wiley and Gleaves, when he's released from prison, set up a gay sauna in London called the London Gay Sun Club. 1980, Gleaves is arrested and remanded for fraud. The same year, he's investigated for running a security company with young boys, some of the young rent boys he had. And even this company that he set up was even employed at one stage by the boxing promoter Frank Warren for security for one of the boxing events that he did. And Warren is actually interviewed by the press and said if he had known that Gleaves was a P person, that, you know, basically he would have got his face smashed in and this wouldn't have happened. But this just goes to show, anyway, it's no sort of aspersions on Frank Warren here, but what this is showing is that he's how manipulative he is and how he gets himself in these places. But also, if he's supplying young boys, his business connections might be a lot better than if you're not involved in that game. You know what I mean? It, like we've said before, it's the ultimate secret society. Well, Satanism especially is. And after that, it's the P Club.
Absolutely.
You know, again, he keeps getting arrested for fraud. Him and Tommy Wiley got prison for 1984. He's jailed again for 4 years for that. And then a few years later, Gleaves is given a 15-year sentence for the R of two young 15-year-old boys. And that he managed to get access to them because he set up a first aid course. And it would be a residential overnight course. And he was taking boys as young as 8 years old on this course.
When you say it out loud like that, you just wouldn't get away with grabbing a bunch of kids and taking them away somewhere overnight now. And I mean, you would, these things still exist. But I mean, there's just cameras everywhere, and I mean, it is just mind blowing.
Well, right?
Mind blowing.
Well, the thing is, this man, he was cast as Britain's most evil offender against children, yeah. And we hear about Sidney Cook, and I'm going now going to go on about the connections here, because it's all about connections.
Of course.
There was a guy that I interviewed, a victim and a survivor of institutional systemic abuse in the care homes, and his name was James Reeves, and he gave such a powerful interview, and he was basically forced into prostitution and living on the streets because of what he enjoyed in a care home, and he became a rent boy, and he teamed up with other, you know, people of the same ilk, and they were band together like a little band of brothers, for survival reasons, really. Anyway, James, every year he goes and he lays a wreath in Euston Station, and he said, one night we were meant to meet there. It was a Christmas, and we were going to go out as a group, as we always did. We were going to go out and work, so they would go out to the meat rack, and the meat rack was Piccadilly Circus, mainly the Wimpy Bar, the upstairs part of the Wimpy Bar, where the boys would be paraded on the window, and people would walk by, the punters would walk by, usually middle-class, middle-aged white men, and pick out the young boy. These boys all come from the care homes and from abuse, and then they would be taken off and they would be rented out sexually. And another place that they would congregate would be an amusement arcade, only, you know, a matter of 100 metres away from that venue. So it was a hard, hard epicentre of child vice. And we're going to look at why that was real. And many, many kids went missing and never to be seen again.
Yeah.
I want to evidence that shortly as well with a testimony I took from a guy called Paul. But going back to James Reeves, what had happened is he went there to meet his mates, but he had a cold and he was a bit late on parade, and his mates weren't there. So he thought, oh well, I'll go home. He wanted the money for drugs and things like that, but he couldn't find, you know, the income. So he just went and he dosed down somewhere. I don't know where he was living, rough, but anyway. He said he never, ever saw his friends again. And there was, I think, about five of them. Never seen again. Now, bear in mind this guy here, Roger Greaves, at the same time, would patrol that station looking for them young boys. At the same time. And someone was going to squeal on him. And the guy ran off. But the fellow who had a link to this other guy, the squealer, was tortured to death and murdered. In a horrific, you know, like say Billy McPhee, Billy Two Tone, quite a well-documented murder.
Wow.
And his tortured body was found with dozens of stab wounds and broken bones and all sorts. They'd really, really gone to work on
it. I mean, that's sending a message to anybody else that might want to consider opening their mouth, you know?
Yeah, but we got to look at what was going on in this area. I really want people to try and understand what central London must have been like in the mid-70s to early 80s. And there was so much corruption in the police. So much was covered up. And many, many children went missing. Many children went missing. And there was a lot of care home abuse, right? And this is still in living memory. So these were the police operations that went on in such a short period of time. So in 1979, there was it's difficult to spell, Prakovsky or something like porn case. Right. And that was where this guy had set up Tiger Studios, where they were just basically abusing boys, young boys in this studio. But the boys were picked up from Playland, which again was just next to the meat rack. A year later, in 1972, a guy called Leroy James, he was an American. There was a big investigation on him because he was... He set up brothels from boys from Playland. 1974, Brian Johnson. Brian Johnson was a childcare officer for the London Borough Tower Hamlets Council. And he was caught up in all of this central London thing and for the abuse of young boys. So he was a childcare officer for the local council. So he'd be dealing with these cases with these vulnerable kids. And he was investigated for child vice stuff in and around this area. 1974, so the same year, we had what was known as the Maltese Syndicate. Now, the Maltese, again, I'm not throwing a blanket over the race of Malta, sure. But the Maltese, in crime terms, were synonymous with being pimps. And they were, especially around Soho. They made a huge amount of money out of the vice industry. And there was a big investigation in 1974 around the whole vice issue. And that involved a guy called Bernie Silvers. And Bernie Silvers, if anyone's seen that film, Bank Robbery with Jason Statham, when he robs the... It's a big film, and there's like this vice boss. Now, that is Bernie Silvers. And Bernie Silvers was actually sort of business-wise in bed with a few police officers, very senior officers. And one of them was running the vice unit. And this is where I whistle blew when I was on the vice unit. I was one of the detectives on the vice unit, so, and sort of know what that environment's like and how they have the ability to cover things up. And these officers were getting huge amounts of money in the 1970s. They were getting thousands of pounds a week. And that was in the 1970s. And it culminated in one of them, a detective superintendent called, I think it's Moody, Bill Moody, getting 12 years in prison. But, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There were 200 officers involved. And in 1975, the police set up Operation Playland, and they split into several different operations. And it was looking at the vice around this Playland amusement arcade that was, you know, in the environs of the Wimpy Bar, a.k.a. the Meat Rack. And they deliberately split up the operations into several different ones to complicate it because of the involvement of so many members of parliament and VIPs. Right. So the same year that went on, another investigation was set up looking at Roger Gleaves and his hostel ring. There was another vice operation that went on involving a guy called Victor Roach, the same area again, that involved young girls. 1977, David Calderhead was investigated for running the meat rack. He was said to be behind it.
And these were all within a local area of each other, or the same?
All in the local area, all connected to the same venues, the Wimpy Bar or Playland, all of them in such a tight... We've got a couple more to go through, and it's quite important through.
Yeah, keep going, of course.
You know, 1979, the Islington chauffeur ring occurred, and now and these were rent boys were being picked up from these venues by the chauffeur of the mayor of Islington. Right. And again, a big cover up. And at the time,
mayor of Islington.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the time we had, who was the MP? Was it Patricia Hewitt or, there was one of the MPs, Hodge Hewitt, and I can't remember her name. There's a Labour MP who was on that borough, and Hodge Hewitt and it's slipping my mind now. These three women Labour MPs all went on to become right honourables, but they were promoting a pro-paedophile group, a pro-pee group. Sorry, let's see if we can get that right. Called PI, and that was P Information Exchange.
Oh, PI.
And PI is
PI. Horrific. Yeah. Just to be clear, this is the group that wanted to lower the age of consent in the UK to 5.
That's right. And I can't remember one of the female MPs that was pro PI went on and was appointed Minister for Children by Tony Blair. Minister for Children.
Wow. The minister. You know, right? That's triggering. You just need to give me a 30-second rant pause here, John, right? Because how, unless it's undeniable, right, at this stage, that things like this don't happen by accident, right? There's clearly a group that are putting these people in place. It is in our faces, and it infuriates me. And I'm sorry to cut you off. Please continue the rant over.
Well, it gets better because, in 1982, a couple of years later, another major police investigation into Playland and the, instead of shutting the place down and flooding it with coppers, there's this, and of course, when it's an investigation, it's really like the tip of the iceberg. And it was known as the London stroke Liverpool vice ring. And it was kids from the care homes in London and Liverpool were being trafficked down to the vice ring in Playland in central London. So kids from care homes in Liverpool were brought down to London and were being pimped out. 1985 Operation Circus, and that was targeting a guy called Abraham Jacobs, an Islington social worker, and he was running the meat rack in Piccadilly. So get that right. So Abraham Jacobs, an Islington social worker, was running the meat rack. I mean, we need to understand that these boys that were put in the meat rack, some of them were murdered, some of them were killed for sexual gratification, and I'm gonna evidence that in a second.
This is the 70s as well, John. Right? This is the 70s.
This is 1985 now, so we've moved.
If this was 2025, right, or 2050, there's the internet. There's forums for these people to meet online and then plan and meet in real life. That didn't exist then.
That didn't exist then. Yeah.
You don't have all of these people suddenly just, oh, we just all met down the calf. It's ignorance, if you think.
Yeah. This is why this guy, Roger Gleaves, is important. I'm going to tie a few together that we mentioned. But a year later, in 1986, Victor Noisety, a guy that was running a vice ring, he was investigated. 1986, the same year, the Dirty Dozen. Now we've got Sidney Cook and gang. Yeah. Sidney Cook, probably the most infamous child abuser MP this country's ever seen. And you can't tell me that look, crime gangs can't work on each other's territory without some sort of unilateral agreement.
Yeah.
So we've got Roger Gleaves going out there, sweeping the streets clean of young runaway boys. And then they're ending up in these venues, at his hostels, then on these places. And he's running a vice ring. Sidney Cook's doing the same. Abraham Jacobs doing the same. And they're not sharing secrets or they're strangers to each other. And of course not. But Cook and Co. come to notice and are investigated. The same year, 1986, the Met link in for the first time for, a joint operation called Operation Stranger, looking at Co., Cook and Co., because of the bodies of Jason Swift and Barry Lewis were discovered. And Jason Swift, runaway boy, frequenter of the meat rack. Barry Lewis was abducted, and he was very young, Barry Lewis, from the streets of southeast London. He didn't stand a chance, but Jason Swift was sort of in and out, a bit like this young Tommy Wiley, sort of linking in with these men, getting in caught up in homosexual relationships with these peas, and you don't know whether they use these young boys as lures to get more in. You don't know, but Jason Swift's life ended appallingly bad with horrific injuries. Cook, when he was in prison, admitted in his cell to witnessing 15 murders of young boys. He got 19 years. That was reduced on an appeal. So, but it's 15 murders. Now, what if they've all come from this environment? And if that's Cook, what about others? There's so many missing children, so many missing. We never hear about them again. You know, there was another investigation that went on. The same location, all that. A bloke called Alan Brent, who had a babysitting service, who was good friends with Cook. 1987, Operation Hedgerow, a big P ring in the same area. 1989, Operation Orchid, that looked more at Co. and his bigger family, you know. 1998, we're getting nearer to the time. We got the Baden-Powell scout ring, and there was a guy that was called Brian Turner, and he was running the Baden-Powell scout group. Again, just trying to lure people in using that name and being a scout. But he was known as the Chicken Master because these young boys are classed as AKA chickens. And he was good friends with Cook, you see. So Operation Playland, 152 boys made statements. And during one of these operations, five men were arrested, right? And one of them was a guy called Charles Hornby. And Charles Hornby, anyone who sort of, book, something period, says that, I don't know, it's all about, you can look up this encyclopedia of who's who, you know, and then, of course, the Hornbys are in there. And the Hornbys, Simon Hornby, was the CEO of WH Smith. And Charles Hornby and Simon, they're I think they're cousins or something like that to the Parker Bowles family. They're part of the Parker Bowles family. And Charles Hornby went away for his part in the Charles Voice Ring, out of Playland. You know, and then that brings into all the police corruption that went on. Now, a guy came to me when I first started looking into this stuff, probably 2001, 2002. Name was Paul. And Paul was in care homes and bits and pieces all around London. And he ended up being one of the boys on the meat rack. And in Playland, he was one of them. And he would be taken to various places and just odd, you know, badly, brutally, sexually assaulted. And he tells me this story once. He said he was on heroin. He was only a young lad. And he was really, really, really clucking for heroin. And he was in a bad, bad way. And a white Rolls Royce, and where have we heard that? We hear the white Rolls Royce all the time, pulled up. And it had two men in it. They were brothers. And he went to get in it. They sort of indicated for him to come over. He was on the meat rack. And one of the older boys, who he said was his pimp, he said, but it was more of a symbiotic relationship than it was a repressive one. And this lad said to him, don't get in there. He said, the last boys that got in there, the last two boys got in there, we never saw them again. They'll kill you if you get in that car.
Wow.
Anyway, he gets in. And he gets taken to the posh suburb of Hampstead. He said, at big gates, the white Rolls Royce pulls in. And the next thing he knows, it's days later, and he's in intensive care. His colon and his anus has just been ripped open, and he was dying. And these two guys have just brutalized him and arred him and everything they'd done to him, to the point where they thought they'd murdered him. And they dumped what they thought was his lifeless body. Damn. And he said the one thing that really stuck in his mind, by the pain and the damage that they did to him, which was long term, he said the one thing that really stuck in my mind, John, was that while I was dying, they were getting all dressed up and putting on suits, white suits, to go to their niece's christening. And they had these little parcels all tied up. And he said, everyone, I think these were really nice, loving people. And he said, and they're just, as far as they were aware, awed him to death. And he just went on about the reality of being on the streets. So today's one was just sort of tying together what we've been speaking about in our last season of videos. If we look at Brian Fields, you know, probably one of the biggest child murderers this country had. We saw Brian Fields, linked him in potentially with these two boys, which they called the milk carton kids in Birmingham. And Brian Fields went away for the murder of two boys, abduction and murder of two boys, I think it was. He's doing life in Monster Mansion, which is Wakefield, HMP Wakefield. Brian Fields from Surrey. This guy here, Roger Gleaves, is from, you know, lived in Surrey at the same time. We look at Cook. We linked in from the last series, Brian Fields, with someone called Smith that was part of the Dirty Dozen and who was part of Cook's lot. And then we sort of tracked the different missing children. And if you look at how many kids have gone missing around these, if we take like Cook admitting to 15 that he's witnessed murders, you know, maybe he was involved, maybe he wasn't, we don't know, we weren't there, but I'd assume that he was. That might just be the tip of the iceberg. Again, with Fields, many, many missing kids around Fields. I think there was something like the police came out with a statement there could be as many as 35 missing children around Brian Fields. They're all connected, these blokes. And again, Roger Gleaves, how many boys were picked up and ended up in these hostels? How many? You know, and there's a murder around this guy. There's loads and loads of serious, serious sexual offending around this man. He will never stop. He's still out and about. It was he's classed as Britain's most evil man and most dangerous P offender. Yet no one's ever heard of him. No one's ever heard of him.
And I'm right in saying as well that the council actually housed him across the road from a school upon his release,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. They put him in a block of flats in Northumberland Avenue, which is in Tottenham. And he was stuck in there. And there was, you know...
It doesn't make sense unless somebody in the same club as you're in is sort of giving you a little nudge and a little, you know, thanks for doing your time and keeping your mouth shut. We've got you a nice little house opposite a school here.
Yeah, I mean, he's an incredibly dangerous guy. You know, I know this block of flats it was in because I've done quite a lot of investigations there, and they put a lot of vulnerable families in there, like migrant families that come over from war zones and things like that, that won't know the system.
Yeah.
That might have this presumption that all white men are good men. I don't know. And then you get, you know, and they struggle financially, you know, as well. And you get people like him might then offer to help out, and dangerous, dangerous, dangerous individuals. And again, we don't hear about these people. And do the police ever link anything together? And when you look at the profile of his offending, it's absolutely appalling.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know whether or not there is intelligence that links him to Cook and Co. But I would say, assuming that he does, that they all know each other. I think they all know each other as much as criminals all know each other.
Yeah, I definitely think the higher up the chains you go, the more involvement the top dogs have, and the more known the lesser downs will be to each other, as it is in many criminal structures.
But you know, like this Playland and the Wimpy Bar, that a girl rang me up the other week, and she used to work in the Wimpy Bar in Piccadilly, and she said, John, it was just appalling. She said one old man would bring in every night about 8 young boys, and she said they were about 7 years old minimum age, and they would be there like earlier, because it was like a 24-hour venue, 2 early hours in the morning, they'd give them a milkshake, and then another boy would meet up and start ferrying the little kids off to different people. She said, I watched it every night. The manager did nothing. The police never came in and did anything. And it was serious, serious sexual offending going on. And it was a conspiracy as well because of these people involved. Yeah, you drop a cigarette butt and they'll have you.
It blows my mind to even imagine a day and age where in the evening shift at a Wimpy restaurant, a bunch of kids can get walked, you know, lined up and handpicked. It's just,
but I mean, if you put it another way, there, right? You've got street vendors that get moved on, hot dog salesmen get moved on, street artists get moved. You park your taxi. The black cab drivers can't park there. They struggle to pick up fares there because it's now red routes, but back then it would be double yellow lines, right? So they'll be on you for that. Yet this stuff. And I've just gone through the first 20 minutes of this interview, and we've been speaking about the operations that went on there. Yeah. You know, I think there was about 20 operations, 18 to 20 operations that went on within, you know, just not short of a decade. Yeah, all from the same venue. It's a hotbed. It's a hotspot of the most appalling criminality with some of the most dangerous lowlife this country's got, and I mean dangerous, that have the propensity and the capacity and the ability to murder children.
Yeah.
And in the worst circumstances ever.
And it's this pattern of prolonged, torturous, you know, R-word related deaths. That's the thing that links all this together.
Well, especially when you get, you know, the mayor of Islington is chauffeur. We've got a social worker for Islington that are involved in running it. And then when you've got Hodge, Hewitt, and I wish I could remember a name. I can't remember the three of them that are pro-pie and you
that's
the main epicenter of this was Labour Council for Islington, and there was big scandals in Islington, you know, around the abuse in the care homes, and nothing was done about it. Even Corbyn was told about it. Jeremy Corbyn, when he was at the member of parliament for that borough, and he did nothing. So where do we go? And you got, like, you know, the Operation Playland, when they dyspraxic, they split it. So the MPs and the VIPs, such as Charles Hornby, because he got named as well as being involved, don't get caught up because they're high up in you know, the acolytes, the link to the royal family, and it all gets brushed under,
speaking of the royal family, there was a bust a few weeks ago of the guy who literally painted King Charles's coronation portrait. Lived next door to Princess Diana for years. Really, really, I mean, we're talking 40 years friendship with the king. He was an advisor, a paid advisor, and worked for the royals for a period of time. Handwritten letters from Diana, painted every one of the royals. His art is amazing. That's why, you know, he is where he is. But again, he was busted by a P-word group. We covered it on A Royal Mess about 3 weeks ago. He was busted for trying to meet up with underage boys. And one paper in the whole of the UK have covered the story, and that was the Blackpool Times, because it was in Blackpool. It's wild when you see so many cases from a P-word group that are textbook evidence, boom, charge, done, next one, da, da, da. And they're a very successful group. They can't understand what is going on. The guy got a police escort driven back after his arrest when he was on bail. When have you ever heard of the police driving you back to your house when you've been released on bail?
Well, I need to search it.
Well, the search has been done. The search has been done.
They were it wouldn't happen. And what I want to say to that pea hunting group, welcome to our world. This is the reality of it. And, be prepared, because they don't want it coming out. You know, when you look at the scandal that came out of Operation Playland and the people that were involved, people like Peter Wright and, you know, very high up, and Peter Wright, and I think he wrote the blueprint for social work. And then you've got the head of the intelligence services at the time, Sir Peter Hayman, convicted of penis. Penis. That sounded a bit wrong. Penis.
Yeah, that did sound wrong. But anyway, we get what you mean. And again, it's quite, you know, of all the research I've ever done and the work I've ever done, these conversations, because it's our home turf, the UK, this is our backyard, okay? And a lot of the stuff I used to do was spread around so that, you know, it wasn't so much in my own backyard. When you realize how high up the P-word group goes, and when you look in periods of time, just looking at data, just looking at this case, there is no way accidentally all those people collectively stumbled into each other, created that network. They were placed. It was almost like it was a tiny island, if you know what I'm saying. And as one fell away, another one was replaced. It's shocking.
What shocks me more is a short video that I put out last time. There's a reluctance of the press to cover it properly and journalistically. They don't do it. They used to. And I said that Roger Cook was on it. He was on it. He was doing his work, and the papers would out name and shame, especially the working class ones like The Sun and The Mirror. They were on it. They used to put exposés out about the peas. Nothing now. Nothing. Well,
that's capitalistic reach for you, because it's not that they don't want it. It's just who owns them now.
Well, and again, look at Channel 4 with the group Hoaxed, which is not a pro-satanic group. Any time I put something out there about Satanism, this group's on it. And there's a woman called Karen Irving who's was given special thanks by Channel 4. She's a vexated twisted individual, in my opinion. As soon as you put out anything about Satanism, you'll get the likes of Karen Irvin, aka El Coyote, and the Hoaxed group trying to shut you up because you're speaking about the darkness, and they don't want it. And then you've got Channel 4 endorsing it and putting out this useless bit of journalistic nonsense. It's weird, it's bizarre, and we're being failed, people. We are being failed, you know, and God bless the pea hunters.
I'll be honest.
You know, crack on, boys, crack on.
I just want to say one thing as well. The extent of the weird, we're not even allowed to say the name of that documentary and that area, okay, on this channel. You've said it out of context into the case that we're referring to, on you know, the Heath, shall we say. And it's weird. I can't even talk about it, but there's so many weird things that have happened directly and indirectly surrounding that case. I just want to say as well, massive shout out to the over 520 people who are watching us on Twitter right now, the 180 on YouTube, and the two. Once again, Facebook, you are the bottom of the pile with our two viewers on Facebook. Big shout out to you guys. Thank you for coming and joining us.
Two viewers on Facebook.
Two on Facebook, 500. Honestly, Sean Atwood on Twitter is a madness. Like, the viewership is huge. So big shout out to you guys. Do whatever it is you do on Twitter. What is it? Do you repost, retweet, re-X? What is it now? I don't know. Do that. Do all the good stuff. That would be great. But again, John, it was an absolute fucking nightmare of an episode. I keep going to say it was a great episode. It was brilliant research. It was well told, but it was just absolutely harrowing again. And, you know, we'll be back next week with more. But I think it's important, John, right? And you'll know this from being a man of faith, okay? It's important to sort of take care of ourselves a little bit. Okay.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So for the last 5 minutes of the show, we're going to talk about it. Well, everyone gets to look at cute guinea pigs and cute little animals to sort of bring them back from the dark realm. Bring them back from the dark realm a little bit, John. All right.
Do you know the strange thing is, the videos like that will get 1 million views.
Oh, they'll get a million. Mate, do you know how many views this video has?
Yeah,
1 million views, exactly, mate.
Yeah, I know. They'll get, it's bizarre, you know, what entertains people, and it's the addictive nature of TikTok as well.
It is. But I think we can all do with 5 minutes of, like, look. We're not going to wonder why that baby tiger is in that guy's lap and the horribleness of mass breeding these animals. Let's just look at the cute animals for a couple of minutes. And then we'll
end. Yeah, you can't stare into the abyss, you know. Uh-huh. And we do these things, so there is an awareness. So we can have a nice, happy, innocent life.
Well, this is the thing. I think it's important what we do, but I think it's also important that we take 5 minutes to either put a smile on everyone's face or make them laugh at the end. Because I feel like even spreading this information and the harsh impact it has is almost allowing the monsters to win a little bit, because we can't even educate people without traumatizing them. I've just spilled a drink all over myself and it's freezing cold. No. Oh my God. Okay, let's just leave it there.
Yeah, I think don't deal with that.
And well, thank you everyone for watching. I'm a very chilled Ron Swanson. Thank you, John Wedger. Let's just go. I can't even do the ending. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye. Like, share. All that stuff.
God bless. God bless everyone.